Today, Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey, the journalists behind the story that launched a global movement. And which parties could benefit from a December election? In the summer of 2017, New York Times journalist Megan Toohey was on maternity leave when she got a call from another journalist at the paper, Jodi Kantor. The two had never spoken before, but Jodi was working on a story and needed Megan's help.
You know, I will confess that I was a little skeptical in the beginning.
Both Jodi and Megan had investigated sexual misconduct and workplace harassment in the past, but they were about to embark on a story in unfamiliar territory, Hollywood. Jodi wanted Megan to work with her on an investigation into the producer, Harvey Weinstein.
To be honest, as investigative reporters, we really strive to do stories that help give voice to the voiceless. And I had a hard time conceiving of people like Gwyneth Paltrow and Ashley Judd as sort of victims who were in need of the help of the New York Times. But Jodi really sat me down and she said, listen, if this is happening to women like this who do at this point have a lot of resources, then it suggests that nobody's immune. And if we're able to bring this to light, we might be able to make a difference.
What they uncovered became one of the biggest stories of our time.
Now to the latest on Harvey Weinstein, the New York Times reporting allegations by numerous women who say the Hollywood mogul sexually harassed them. His alleged victims over nearly three decades include stars like Ashley Judd and Rose McGowan.
It is a story that had consequences far beyond Harvey Weinstein, who faces trial in January. It fueled a worldwide Me Too movement and led to accusations being made against men not just from the world of entertainment, but sport, politics, journalism, and so many other industries. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, the investigative journalists who broke the Harvey Weinstein story. So you both begin trying to get to the bottom of what actually was one of Hollywood's biggest sort of open secrets, really, wasn't it? What was the first thing that you did? I mean, where on earth do you begin with something like this?
Great question, because believe me, we were asking ourselves the same thing. We were sitting around the office saying, how do you get Uma Thurman's phone number? How do you get Salma Hayek's phone number? But what happened is that we started in April. Megan was still on maternity leave. And between May and June, I spoke to the actor Rose McGowan, Ashley Judd, another actor, and Gwyneth Paltrow. And they each told me really harrowing Harvey Weinstein hotel room stories. And that was the first clue that there was a kind of pattern here.
And that pattern was not just limited to actors.
What we realized as we pushed forward with the reporting is that those famous actresses were actually just one category of alleged victims, that there were also many women who had gone to work for Harvey Weinstein in the companies that he ran. And what we realized is that many of those women had also been allegedly targeted by Weinstein. So that was another real significant moment where we realized that there were two categories of alleged victims. And not just that, but that he had been able to cover up some of his alleged violations through secret settlements.
The UK is really a ground zero for the Weinstein investigation. Mm. And in the category that Megan just explained of these former Weinstein assistants, there are women in the UK who had shocking stories. And two of them, Zelda Perkins and Laura Madden, helped us in our investigation. And these were huge breakthroughs in the story. Laura Madden had been a very young, very new assistant on a film, Into the West, that was shot in Ireland in the early 90s. And Laura is Irish. She lives in Wales now. Really, the first day she ever met Harvey Weinstein, I mean, it's a classic Weinstein hotel room story, and it's a bad one. You know, her story is the story of an assault. And part of what was really memorable about that first conversation with Laura was her determination. She was very nervous to speak. Of course, I mean, she was being called by this journalist from halfway across the world. She didn't know me. She didn't know if she could trust me. But she had just gotten another phone call. She had gotten a call from a former Weinstein assistant who was trying to pressure her not to speak. This former Weinstein assistant knew that there were journalists calling around, I guess knew that Laura had a story. And the former Weinstein assistant referred to Megan and I as cockroach journalists and told her not to speak to Megan and I. And Laura did not like the idea of being silenced. And so she shared her story with us. And it was very important because, first of all, it pretty much matched the actress hotel room stories, not in all of the particulars, but it had that eerie, haunting, repetitive quality that so many of the Weinstein stories do.
So you began to document this pattern of alleged predatory behavior stretching back as far as 1990 and mostly taking place in hotel rooms. And then alongside this, there was also a trail of secret payoffs that Weinstein was making with these women for their silence.
That became another path of our reporting. In the end, we were able to show that Weinstein had paid as many as 12 secret settlements to silence women from 1990 through 2015. These were basically tools that allowed him to cover his tracks and go on to allegedly hurt more people.
Weinstein went to great lengths to try and keep these women silent. And when he found out about your investigation, he used his considerable power and resources to try and stop you too.
As we were working to cross the finish line and put this work into the world for everybody to see, we were encountering more and more hurdles. You know, Weinstein had employed these high-priced lawyers to make legal threats against us. You know, we would later learn that he was working with an investigative firm of a whole nother order, Black Cube, made up of these former Israeli intelligence officials.
A new report says Harvey Weinstein used a so-called army of spies to block the reporting of sexual misconduct allegations against him.
Who had basically been promised $300,000 if they could put a stop to our investigation. Once we finally went to Harvey Weinstein for comment, that 48-hour period for us really turned into a serious roller coaster as Weinstein employed more and more desperate tactics, which included barging into the New York Times the day before we were supposed to publish to try to stop us. That was actually ultimately motivating for us. I mean, the more that we saw of the bullying and intimidation and other types of tactics that he had used to kind of push his way through the world, the more determined we were to make sure that we would be able to publish.
We should say it wasn't just women that you spoke to as well. You know, men were also part of this. And you got some crucial leads from men who were working within the Weinstein company. What do you think motivated them to speak to you?
Well, you're absolutely right. We found that a sort of consistently surprising theme in all of this is who helped and who hindered. And Gwyneth Paltrow was one of our best sources, which nobody would have expected. And then the kind of deep throat of the Weinstein investigation, who provided some very crucial information, was A, a man, who B, was working at the Weinstein company at the time, who C, was Harvey Weinstein's own company accountant of 30 years. He had quietly done the books for all of these movies that we've seen. His name is Irwin Ryder. You know, he had had sort of glimpses of wrongdoing, especially in the 90s, and he really didn't speak up. He didn't try to find out more. But in 2014, he started hearing more office chatter about Weinstein and women. And at the time, the Cosby case was really in the headlines. And so just to show you how sort of one of these Me Too stories affects the next, he had a panic. He said, what if we have a Bill Cosby situation on our hands? And interestingly, his immediate moral concern at that time was not for the women and whether they had been hurt. He thought, this is going to doom this company. Inside the Weinstein Company, 2014 and 2015, these incidents and allegations are becoming more visible to the company leadership. And what we found is that people did try to act and they failed. Irwin Ryder ends up feeling very sort of defeated. So when we called him in the fall of 2017, we didn't know this, but we were reaching somebody who was very frustrated because he had tried other avenues for addressing this problem and he had failed.
I mean, it must have been quite surprising to you, though, that he was your source. I mean, incredibly unlikely.
he was quite tortured and angry about what he had seen and heard. And so we started meeting late at night that September, and he started giving us information, and the things Irwin was saying, they checked out. He had mentioned this memo, and I didn't really know what it was. He started to pull it up on his phone, and it seemed like maybe he was going to read me more of it. And then he stopped, and he looked at his phone, and he looked at me, and he said, "I'm going to take a trip to the little boy's room," and he handed me his phone open to the memo. So he's like telling me without telling me to copy the memo. So he disappears to the bathroom, and I'm saying to myself, I hope his phone doesn't lock. And I take out my phone and I screenshot the entire memo. I didn't have time to read it because I wanted his phone waiting for him on his chair by the time he got back to the bathroom. So then when our drinks date was done, I immediately went to the bathroom. I sent it to Megan and our editor, Rebecca Corbett. And it turns out I think the three of us read it sort of in parallel that night. And that's when it sank in that this was a really powerful piece of evidence.
God, I can only imagine like how sort of sweaty your palms must have been as you were trying to screenshot that memo and get it done in time. What was in that memo that turned out to be so important? Mm-hmm.
So the memo had been written by Lauren O'Connor, who really is one of the most remarkable figures in the Weinstein story. She was a junior executive in 2015.
She penned an internal memo about her boss that would later become famous. In it, she wrote, "I am a 28-year-old woman trying to make a living and a career. Harvey Weinstein is a 64-year-old world-famous man, and this is his company. The balance of power is me, zero, Harvey Weinstein, 10.
And basically did something that so few people in Weinstein's orbit had ever had the courage to do. She submitted a lengthy memo to HR detailing all of the alleged sexual harassment and other abusive behavior that she had witnessed by the boss.
And I think, you know, when I filed the memo, I knew it was at great risk to my career and my professional track. But I think on some level, and I don't know still if it was naive or not, but I really hoped that if something was in writing, then when HR read it, they wouldn't be able to unknow that. In the same way that when a young woman told me what happened to her, I couldn't unhear it.
And she wasn't describing any kind of alleged sexual assault that she had experienced personally. It was more sort of what she had been in the orbit of. She described when one of Weinstein's assistants had come to her, you know, in tears about being kind of forced into an uncomfortable naked massage situation with Weinstein. She was talking about being forced to help arranged meetings between Weinstein and actresses that she sort of suspected were predatory in nature. And so she was really kind of outlining all of the various types of behavior that Jody and I had been piecing together going back decades. And we realized that this was something that had landed in the hands not just of HR, but that the entire board of the Weinstein Company had been made aware of it.
Even with all of this information, you still needed at least one woman to go on the record with her name before you could publish your story. Even before you started this investigation, you note that the journalist Jennifer Senior tweeted, "At some point, all the women who've been afraid to speak out about Harvey Weinstein are going to have to hold hands and jump." And this is where Laura Madden, the Irish assistant you described earlier, played such a crucial role.
Yes, like everybody else, Laura really wanted to be part of a group of women coming forward, understandably so. I think everybody understood the dynamic from the beginning that it would be much more powerful and effective if a group of women essentially confronted Weinstein at the same time. But nobody wanted to be the first to jump. And remember that we couldn't tell our sources who our other sources were, because that would have been a violation. It would have endangered everybody. And so Laura was nervous, but she was working up her courage. I remember her saying to me, I really want this story to work. This story has to work. But then as we got closer to publication, we realized that there was going to be a terrible collision. Laura had faced breast cancer just shortly before then, and she had this surgery, this upcoming surgery that was sort of looming on the horizon. She needed a mastectomy and reconstructive surgery. And we realized to our horror that the date of her surgery was pretty much going to collide with the date of publication. And it was an awful situation because we thought, how could we possibly ask her to do this? But on the other hand, we couldn't afford to lose her because at that point, she was really our only woman who had given an interview on the record about the victimization. To be clear, we had other forms of evidence. We had, you know, 25 years of allegations. We had company memos and the legal and financial trail of the settlements. But we really, really needed women on the record. So Laura, the morning we finally published, Thursday, October 5th, we woke up to an email from Laura. I feel obliged to talk about the events that happened to me at Miramax as I realize that I'm in the fortunate position of not being employed in the film business, and so my livelihood won't be affected. I'm also not one of those that have been silenced, even though individuals under Harvey Weinstein have tried to persuade me to be silent. I do not have a gagging order against me either. I feel I am speaking out on behalf of women who can't because their livelihoods or marriages may be affected. I am the mother of three daughters, and I do not want them to have to accept this kind of bullying behavior in any setting as normal. I have been through life-changing health issues and know that time is precious and confronting bullies is important. My family are all supportive of my decision. I am happy to go on record.
I really loved reading in the book about those moments when the first story went live, you pushed the button and it was published, and then those hours after. But this was really only just the beginning of everything that you started doing, because you kept working and you published follow-ups and you had accounts from actresses like Gwyneth Paltrow, who felt able to go on the record because of their power and numbers. And, you know, lots of women who contacted you in the wake of this, you know, it sounds like you were just being sent emails and, you know, contacted all the time. Did you ever expect this to snowball in the way that it did?
No, definitely not. In fact, a few nights before the story was published, Megan and I were at the office until midnight or something, and we finally took a taxi home. And by the time we got back to our places in Brooklyn, we had said to each other, is anybody going to care? Is anybody going to read? We did not take the impact for granted at all. I mean, I certainly felt the power of what we were reporting, but I thought, oh, maybe on the Oscars next year, maybe somebody will make one joke about Harvey Weinstein.
I think in terms of seeing just this outpouring of women coming forward, not just to the New York Times, but to other news organizations and coming out on social media with their own stories of sexual harassment and abuse, we never saw that coming. We never could have predicted that.
Harvey Weinstein's always denied all of the allegations.
Weinstein's lawyer tells CBS News, quote, the New York Times published a story that is saturated with false and defamatory statements about Harvey Weinstein.
And he's now facing criminal charges. It's been 2 years since you first published that story, and it's fair to say that it's a story that really changed people and changed the way that we see the world that we live in. Do you think enough has changed?
Oh, what's totally confounding is that everything's changed and nothing's changed. On the one hand, social attitudes really have shifted, and the wave of kind of firings and resignations, especially in the States, but here in the UK as well, is, I think, unlike anything we've ever seen. This has become a serious reputational risk for companies. But on the other hand, laws and systems have not really shifted. And I think there's a great danger that if they don't, there's nothing to sort of lock in place these changes in social attitude.
On Wednesday night, Harvey Weinstein was spotted at a showcase for emerging acting talent in New York.
I'm a comic. And it's our job to name the elephant in the room. Do we know what that is?
Yeah,
it's a Freddy Krueger in the room, if you will. I didn't know that we have to bring our own maze and rape whistles to Actors Hour.
And there were several women there who expressed huge anger and upset that he was present.
Nobody's going to say anything. Nobody's really going to say anything. I'll get out of here. That's fine. I am happy to leave. and nobody's going to say anything.
Were you surprised that he made such a public outing?
We've been getting reports of them for weeks. People are constantly sending us like texts and emails with photos attached of Harvey Weinstein spotted around New York City. His situation now going into trial is that he can move around New York and Connecticut, but not beyond, and he wears an ankle bracelet. And so he often goes out to dinner and whatnot in New York City, it seems. You know, I think that that confrontation shows us why this trial is so important. It's so important that there's going to be an official verdict on what he did or didn't do.
Megan and Jody, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Harvey Weinstein has denied all accusations of non-consensual sex. The Weinstein Company said the allegations had come as an utter surprise to the board, and any suggestion that the board had knowledge of this conduct is false. Harvey Weinstein's former personal assistant, Zelda Perkins, spoke to us on the podcast in May about non-disclosure agreements. You can listen to that episode at theguardian.com. Coming up, could we be heading for the first December general election in nearly 100 years? Now, the government's call for a general election on the 12th of December failed to win enough support last night, hours after the EU agreed to a Brexit extension until the end of January. But there are still other routes that lead to a winter election. Guardian columnist Raphael Baer looks at the calculations the parties are making.
So it feels as if this election that everyone's been talking about might actually happen. The snowball has gathered enough mass to roll down the hill, and we're all going to be voting in the dark days of December. Something that has not happened for many decades, and with good reason. Generally, it is felt that people don't like turning out to the polls, possibly when it's raining or even snowing and dark, ice on the streets. Who knows what will happen? Boris Johnson has obviously come to the conclusion that he needs this campaign while his Brexit deal is still the only one in town, and that he can run against a parliament that has been thwarting, as he would see it, the will of the people. Now, he has finally been abetted in that project, it seems, by the Liberal Democrats, who have also decided that what they really need is to fight a general election before Brexit has definitely happened, because, frankly, stopping Brexit is pretty much the only policy they've got that anyone knows about. Now, one thing that the Liberal Democrats and the Tories have in common in this respect is what they really want to do is fight a general election with Jeremy Corbyn leading the Labour Party, because all the opinion polls show that Corbyn is about the least popular leader of the opposition ever recorded. Now, some of Jeremy Corbyn's supporters, including his Praetorian Guard in Parliament, will believe that he can pull off something similar to what he did in 2017, defying the polls, rising up the ratings, and actually disappointing a lot of the people who thought he would be swiftly dispatched by the electorate. He's still there. Of course, one of the key factors in 2017 is that Theresa May fought what is pretty much recognised to have been the worst general election campaign in history. Boris Johnson fancies himself as quite a strong campaigner, but he's got other problems as well. Now, one of the reasons he'd quite like this whole election business sorted by the end of this week is because we were supposed to be leaving the EU on the 31st of October. Now, that's not going to happen, which means he has betrayed the single biggest pledge that he made when he became Tory leader. He said he would rather die in a ditch than ask for the Brexit extension, which he is now accepting. Now, that brings the Brexit Party and Nigel Farage back into play, because the one thing that they like to do is complain that the Tories just aren't being Brexity enough. And if enough people vote for the Brexit Party in certain key seats, that eats into the Tory vote, and maybe Labour can come through the middle. The problem we've got here is that some of the people that used to vote Labour certainly voted Labour in 2017 because they don't like Brexit. Well, they might now be backing the Lib Dems. So hang on a second, we've got a war here on two fronts. We've got Labour fighting the Lib Dems for the Remain vote. Labour also trying to hint that they're also a bit Brexity for some of their Brexit-supporting voters in key marginal seats. You've got the Tories trying to take Labour voters who actually maybe like Brexit more than they like Jeremy Corbyn. But you've also got the Brexit Party trying to take those same Leave voters off the Tories. And just to complete the circle, you've got the Lib Dems appealing to Tory voters who actually don't really like Brexit all that much. But then, of course, north of the border, you've got the SNP, who might completely sweep the board because the one thing that they know for sure is that they don't want an English Tory party led by Boris Johnson dragging Scotland out of the European Union against its will. So, it's hard for the Tories to get a majority if they're not winning any seats in Scotland, if they're shedding votes to the Brexit Party here and the Lib Dems there. It's hard for the Labour Party to get a majority if they're shedding also votes to the Lib Dems, but struggling to hold on to their Leave-supporting voters in all sorts of English constituencies. Also probably not making a lot of progress in Scotland. So, what's going to happen? Well, I'm not going to tell you. It's anybody's guess. Guarantee, absolute mess.
That was Raphael Bear. Thanks to him, Jodie Cantor and Megan Toohey. Today's episode was produced by Mithali Rao and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Kakoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.